Hi everyone, welcome back to the Public Interest Environmental Law podcast brought to you by Peel UK. We hope you enjoyed last episode, and today we have a new episode with Anthony Fountain. We are your hosts, Jocelyn
and Steffi
and Rosrin.
Welcome Anthony, thank you for joining us on the Peel podcast. Before we dive into our deeper questions, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to where you are now?
Thanks Jocelyn, thanks for having me here, it's a pleasure. My name's Anthony, working in the cocoa sector for the last 17 years, and I got involved in this 17 years ago because my wife brought home one of the first bars of a small Dutch chocolate company called Tony's Chocolate Only. And at the time on the wrapper, it said 100% slave-free chocolate. And I was, of course it's slave-free. We abolished that quite some time ago. But then I found out, my wife explained to me kind of the realities of children having to work on farms rather than going to school and the horrible labor conditions they were under. And sometimes you hear something and you're like, oh gosh, somebody needs to do something about this. But for me, it hit me at a very visceral level. And I was like, no, I need to do something about this. So at the time I was working in marketing and had been doing so for quite a while. But I was like, nope. This is something I need to be doing. And so somewhere in the 3 or 4 weeks that followed, a whole bunch of, you can call them coincidences if you want. If you don't believe in coincidences, you can call them something else. But about 3 or 4 weeks later, here I was handing in my resignation for the marketing firm I was at and helping to set up a very small anti-trafficking campaign in the Netherlands at the time. And one thing led to the other, and 17 years later, I'm still doing this, but looking at a much broader set of issues. Because child labor and child trafficking, as horrible as they are outcomes of root causes that lie deeper than that, often around poverty, around rule of law, around kind of the systemic injustice of the supply chain. And so that really is what we're trying to focus on nowadays.
Thank you for sharing that. It's really interesting and quite enlightening. Now, moving on from yourself, could you tell us a few words and introduce the Voice Network for our listeners?
Yeah, so we're an umbrella organization of about 30 NGOs and trade unions from across the entire world. So we've got members in every inhabited continent of the planet, whether that's Japan, Australia, Latin America, West Africa, Europe, the United States. And what we try to do is we try to organize the countervailing power in the cocoa sector. So it really doesn't matter what system you're in, that system will always have people that are in power. And that power always needs to be held accountable. And I think that's what civil society is there for. But very often civil society isn't strong enough. A lot of small NGOs or even the bigger ones focusing on individual topics, whereas all these topics are interlinked. Together we know more, but also together we can do so much more. And so what we do at Voice is we bring together all of the civil society voices that we can and try to create a common front and try to align on the key challenges and on the key recommendations that what we think needs to happen. And in that context, we do look at all of the problems in the cocoa sector. So whether that's poverty or environmental degradation or child labor or labor rights or gender inequality or the use of agrochemicals or climate change or the need for regulation in consuming countries, all of these different things is what we bring together.
Brilliant. Thanks for that. And could you tell us a little bit about how poverty, deforestation, child labor or slave labor are interlinked?
Mm-hmm. So I often describe the problems in the cocoa sector as there's like a problem tree, almost literally, right? And one of the big branches of these problems are environmental, and we're dealing with issues like deforestation, climate change, use of agrochemicals, et cetera, et cetera. The other huge branch is on the human rights side, where we have child labor and child trafficking and gender inequality and labor rights issues, et cetera. But all of those are driven by this big tree trunk of farmer poverty, right? And it doesn't mean that if you'd solve poverty, there would be no more child labor, there'd be no more gender inequality, there'd be no more deforestation. But the job to solve those problems becomes exponentially harder when the farmers are dirt poor, Because if you have to choose between feeding your family and protecting the forest behind your house, that is not a choice that you have, right? If you have to choose between having your family go hungry or having them help on the farm, that is not a choice that you have, right? And so they're deeply interlinked and often through the veins of a farmer poverty. But that tree stands on roots, and those roots are around the rule of law. Those roots are around government policies. Those roots are around landscape approaches, because none of these problems in cocoa are unique to cocoa. And none of them can just be solved on the farm level, right? The child labor, the deforestation, all of these issues need to be solved in broader landscapes. And so, and the industry and the public sector are also very opaque about their dealings. And so there's not a lot of transparency. And so those are the roots that we see to the poverty. And so that means that there are no simple solutions. Everything is intertwined, and you can't just say, if we just solve this one thing, there wouldn't be any problems. But at the same time, you do know you need to look at the core of where most of these problems come from, and that's poverty. And there are a couple of approaches there that aren't rocket science that you can solve, but the problems are all interlinked. And then one thing that I mentioned on the branch of human rights, but is actually cross-cutting through everything here, is the issue of gender equality. And I think that that point can't be stressed strongly enough, is that in almost every problem that we find in the cocoa sector, there is a component of women not having the same opportunities and the same rights as men. Now, this is a problem from a rights-based perspective, because women should have the same amount of rights, but it also becomes a problem of finding the solutions, because it's not just that gender equality is an issue because of the rights that women have. Gender inequality is a problem because gender equality actually is often one of the best solutions to almost all of the problems. If you give women more rights or more ability to decide how the household spends their money, the money tends to be spent better. If women have better access to market and access to the family finances, that money gets spent better than if the men have all of the access to it. If you bring women in on board as part of the solution to child labor, kids actually go to school and have better access to the materials they need to go to school. The same thing goes around deforestation. If you give women land rights and tree tenure security, they can be part of the solution there as well. And the problem there is not the women, right? The problem there is the men. And so on gender inequality, and I feel very passionately about this, it's so cross-cutting because we design everything from the status quo. Like even our forest interventions, even our poverty interventions are like, oh, we need trainings. Yeah, how are you going to make sure the woman can go to the training or has access to the training? We need tree tenure security. How are you going to make sure women in cultures where they often don't have tree tenure or land tenure, how are you going to make sure that they get those rights as well, right? And so even the sustainability interventions that we do see, if they're not designed to purposefully include women, what they often do is they actually create more inequality rather than less. And so this cross-cutting issue of gender equality in all of this is something I feel quite strongly about. And I would say that at a similar level, bringing in inclusion in a broader sense. So how do you strengthen the voice of rights holders, particularly in vulnerable communities? How do you strengthen the voice of the global South in this conversation? Because your question is like, how does this all tie in together? Well, part of the inclusion conversation ties into the fact that all of the decisions around any sustainability interventions that we make tend to be made by white men in corridors of power, boardrooms in Europe or the United States. And that means that the solutions and even the problem analysis that we give space to fit the narrative of people like me, middle-aged white guys with an education. And so we're often unaware of the things that we're unaware of. Or even when we are aware of those things, we tend to not prioritize them, often because the things that really are a priority for rights holders tend to be highly inconvenient. Like one of the things that farmers have often said and have been saying for decades now as the core, one of the core solutions to their problems is, one of the things that needs to happen is you need to pay us more for our cocoa or for our coffee or for our tea or for our soy or palm oil. And that's a solution that never seems to be taken very seriously at scale, right? We're like, oh, no, we need more productivity. So once again, turning the farmer into the problem. The farmer needs to solve his own problems. No. What about the stuff that you're doing as a company? Why don't we work on that? So this kind of the imbalance in the representation and the decision-making and even the problem analysis being done in Europe and the US rather than having rights holders at the table means that we often don't solve the problems because we're only approaching it from our perspective of our power and privilege rather than looking at the solutions that people from the ground need. So maybe a bit of a long sermon almost around how these things intertwine, but we really see that all of these problems are linked to poverty, all of these problems are linked to a lack of representation, and all of these problems are linked to women not having the same opportunities and rights as men.
Thank you. That's so interesting, and it's so interesting that you're shedding light on aspects that we probably wouldn't be looking at otherwise. I was wondering, it seems like it's been quite a learning journey for you, I imagine, since you started in that position and uncovering all of these issues you don't talk about much in Europe. I was wondering, how has that affected your path and your approach to advocacy over your career?
I love that question because it is always a journey, right? And I think that you're often unaware of what you're unaware of, but the journey always goes through this matrix of kind of your unaware of your incompetence, and then you start realizing that, hey, I'm not very good at this, and so you're aware of your incompetence, and then you start working on that, and then over time you start realizing, hey, wait, I'm actually starting to do better at this, and then the final stage of that process is that you actually do it naturally, and it becomes a habit, it becomes part of who you are and what you do. And I think on this inclusion, when we started this journey, and I've been doing this for almost 20 years now, I was young, I was highly unaware of most of the stuff that was happening in the world in the first place. And so you go on a journey of, I know about these principles that I care about, but how do you do that? Well, you start figuring out, right? And I think the biggest enemy to going on that journey is thinking that you need to be very good at something before you take the first step, right? And so for me, a big part of my ability to pull this off has been kind of almost like a blissful ignorance of your own incompetence, so to speak, and to just say, how hard could this be? Let's just try it, right? And, somebody's got to do it. It's not being done. Let's try. Because when I started in this, these kind of collaborations weren't there yet either, right? And we've designed this by doing. And a lot of the times we've designed this by doing it by mistakes, right? And smart people, anybody can learn from mistakes that they've made themselves. Smart people learn from other people's mistakes, but we've really had to learn the hard way from our own mistakes time and again. This doesn't work. How do we do this? I am a white guy from Europe. I can't speak on behalf of farmers. I am not a farmer, and I will never be. So how do I start finding the people that are and the people that can? And how do I give them platform instead of putting myself on stage, right? And those are questions that you start asking. Is like, and then you realize, hey, wait, for me, I mean, I've been on and off stage since I was a kid, like in performance arts, and I had an attempt at a career at being a professional pop musician and a frontman in a rock band for a while, and I don't mind that, and that's the most natural thing to kind of to stroke my own ego, but that's not what we're here for. We're actually here to create space for other voices to be heard, and then, but I feel comfortable on stage. Why don't you feel comfortable on stage? Well, maybe because I've never been there before. Okay, so maybe I can start bringing you alongside and showing you, hey, this is how I've done it. This is how I would do it. But everybody has their own voice. So find your own voice, etc. So it's part of a journey, basically. But if you think you need to figure out all of the steps before you go on that journey, you'll never start. And so sometimes the most important thing is to just try it and don't be afraid to fail, because you will. right? So if you're afraid to fail and that stops you from doing it, well, that's a shame because everybody fails. I mean, that's the whole definition of trying stuff, right? But it's not always been an easy process, and it's something that also, it requires tremendous intentionality, because the way the world works and the world has worked for a very long time is the default, and we're trying to break that mold. And so getting out of the mold always requires effort, always requires being willing to veer off track and try new things. And especially when it comes to kind of centering the voice of the South, or whatever, I think we still haven't found the right words, right? Where we know what we're not allowed to call it, but we don't really feel comfortable what to call the fact that there are different perspectives to privilege, right? So centering the underprivileged is something that is uncomfortable. It's something that also requires you to be willing to have your own analysis challenged as well. And so, like, for many years, we were a network of consuming nation organizations, started in Europe, then slowly added Australia and the US to it. And we're like, that's not right. Let's broaden it. Although there were also reasons why we did it that way, right? Because, and also some good reasons, like we didn't want to try to speak on behalf of the Global South because we couldn't, and it wasn't our mandate. But at the same time, we also realized, but that means where is the voice of the Global South? And so, like, what if we work together? And so, but then when you ask Southern organizations to come in, you can't just ask them to come in to agree with what you're saying, right? When you ask them to come in, the first place that they have a right to speak and to challenge assumptions is with us. It's not even with the multinationals. It's not even with the governments, right? So when you do start that inclusion and diversity and decolonization journey, you're not, first of all, decolonizing the sector, you're decolonizing yourself. And that process, I think, never ends, because we've been steeped in, you know, we abolished colonization way before I was born, but the culture we are in is still based on this idea. And there's some pretty racist assumptions in all commodities, right? So African farmers are poor. There's a really race. It doesn't have to be that way. That's not the default. They're poor because we've oppressed Africa for centuries, and we've designed a system, even after we officially started stopped oppressing them, that still is based on exploitation, right? And yeah, but that's because their governments are corrupt. Why do you think that is? That's not the natural state of things, right? That's designed. And you need to continuously go through a journey where you realize, wait a minute, the way things are is not the way things have to be. And that means that you continuously need to be challenging your own assumptions about why the way things are the way they are.
Since Global South organizations have come on board to the Voice Network, what do you think is the biggest thing you've learned, or the biggest thing that has shocked you or changed your perception of the cocoa sector?
I love that question. So there are so many different voices and perspectives there. And I think for me, it's been a real, I'm not sure if the shock is the right word, but it's been an enrichment to kind of appreciate the vast range of different kinds of voices and perspectives and priorities and ways of looking at it. It's like, we've, like, a third of our membership organizations now are based in the Global South. And there's a really wide range of perspectives that they bring to the table that also don't agree with each other per se, right? And so there's a very rich conversation to be had there. And some of the most passionate and dedicated individuals, I mean, the one thing that I've really, that is really, that keeps impressing me is just the level of brilliance and dedication of some of our members and partners and allies in West Africa and Latin America, just the courage that they bring to the table, because I don't have to be particularly courageous to do the work that I do, right? It's a very safe kind of a thing to do when you do that from the comfort of Europe. But the way that they can approach this, you know, I'm thinking of some of the individual members here, the way that what they do is something that they passionately believe in for themselves, for their communities, for their families, for their children, for their futures. I really, really, I find that to be one of the most inspiring things.
Thank you. This discussion is so interesting, but I think we should try and include it now into the EU framework, regulatory framework for our audience, and then I think it's a really interesting perspective to keep in mind when we're thinking about these other questions that will come up. Could you just briefly introduce us to the three main EU regulatory texts that are right now in the EU pipelines, which are, to our perception, maybe you can add some if there are, the EU Deforestation Regulation, the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive, and the Proposed Forced Labor Regulation.
Yes, so those are three big ones. There's also a couple of others that we're starting to look at with interest. There's the sustainability reporting, the green claims document as well, which I think will be quite interesting going forward. But so the EU historically has been an incredibly neoliberal project, right? Always aimed at kind of reducing barriers for trade, always aimed at kind of the more free market, the better. And somewhere, somehow, there's this paradigm shift that is taking place at the moment, not just in the EU, we're also seeing that in other countries, and also in the UK, there's a bunch of regulations either already implemented or in the process of being implemented. But we're really living through a really exciting time that comes once every one, two, maybe three generations of really a paradigm shift of how the world thinks the world should be organized, right? And so since the late 70s, early 80s, we've really been operating under this extreme neoliberal Washington consensus that the less rules, the more the market will solve all the problems, right? And I think especially after the fall of the Berlin Wall and this idea, oh, guys, we have reached the end of history. We have won. We have arrived, right? And I think that assumption has been challenged quite strongly over the past decade, to some extent for good, around these regulatory developments that we're seeing, and I'll dive more into detail there, to some extent to the worse as well, because democracy and constitutional democracies are not a given, as we're seeing in many elections across the world at the moment, where kind of the extreme right is rising to power more and more again, and that needs to be defended. So there's a paradigm shift there that should concern every one of us that cares about human rights deeply. But there is at the same time also a paradigm shift that is something that we need to be a lot less concerned about and actually can be quite excited about, that we're living through times where the way we're organizing international structures is changing, and changing rapidly, spearheaded at the moment by the EU around these regulatory developments. So the three main ones that we have is the EUDR, the European Union's Deforestation Regulation, which is quite simply an import ban for commodities of products coming from seven of the major deforestation driving commodities across the world into the EU. If the product that is made with this commodity has come from areas that's been deforested after the 1st of January 2020, which is not that long ago, then it's not allowed to come into the EU. So it doesn't solve historic deforestation, but going forward, it should stop a lot of the deforestation that is still about to happen, right? That got passed last year. It went into implementation. The first phase of the implementation started last summer, but it will actually properly come into force in Christmas of 2024. At which moment you're not allowed to import products that are made through deforestation from cocoa, but also coffee and soy and quite a few other drivers of deforestation. Exactly how that is going to be implemented is still unclear. And so there is some pushback towards the EU around, guys, you've got to speed up your game and make it very clear how you can and cannot be compliant, etc. But also supply chains are really going to have to rush to be compliant anyway, right? I think that everybody, including the cocoa sector, is probably starting their compliancy work on the late side. And it'll be messy for the first 2 or 3 or 4 years before we'll get to a stable basis in a couple of years. But it's incredibly necessary that we have this regulation. At the same time, there are some concerns about the fact that this regulation is very clear about you're not allowed to be part of deforestation, but very unclear about who's going to pay the costs for this. And in that context, if you're unclear about cost of compliance in a market where you've got very strong economic actors and very weak economic actors, it doesn't require an economist to understand who's going to be paying for this. And it's the hint is it's not the strong actors. And so we need to see in this regulation a lot more clarity around you can't just kick cost of compliance up the supply chain until the farmer pays for it, because they're really dirt poor now. In that context, it's really good that we've got the second regulation coming in. And it's important to understand it's not one regulation. It's actually a whole suite of interventions. And the second one is the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive, or CSDDD. Not the most sexy acronym, but, you know, you do with what you've got. And this one goes beyond just deforestation and looks at... and it's also not an import ban. So where the previous one is like, if you've not done this, then you're not allowed to sell. The second one is much more about the process rather than an individual product. And it says, look, if you want to operate in the EU, then you need to have done your due diligence. And due diligence is a complex concept, I guess, for legal professionals, it's a bit less complex. But within this context, there's actually 6 steps. Is you need to have a policy in place around your human rights and environmental policies. Then you need to do a risk analysis. Where in my supply chain have I got real risks on human rights and environmental challenges? Then you need to actually put in place measures that tackle these risks. And then you need to measure whether your interventions are working or not. And you need to communicate that transparently. And then if they're not working, you need to change your plans accordingly. So basically it says it's not an effort-based intervention. It's actually you need to make sure that what you're doing is working. And if it isn't working, then you need to change your plans. But it doesn't mean you can't have problems. It means that if you have problems, you need to start solving them. And I think that in the context of a lot of these human rights and environmental issues that we have in supply chains, that's often a lot more of a realistic approach rather than just saying you're not allowed to have problems, because if you're not allowed to have problems, then you're just going to hide your problems. But this is actually quite realistic. It's saying, look, having problems, we all have problems. We just need to work on them, right? But we also need to work on them in a way that they're working. And if we're not finding solutions, you're going to have to do better or do differently. And so that, in short, is the CSDDD. Now, that has just been the negotiations around what's going to be in the text has just been finalized, or I've understood that there's still a couple of T's that need to be dotted and I's that need to be crossed. But that should be finished and published sometime in the coming week so that it can be then still ratified by the Council and the Parliament prior to the next EU elections, which are this spring. So we're on a schedule here, and we're very close to the final aspect of this. Now, the problem that doesn't mean that it will be implemented directly, because the word directive already says it, and it's different than the deforestation regulation. And within the EU, a regulation is a rule that counts for all 27 member states and gets implemented and developed by the European Union. A directive means that all 27 member states have to develop their own national legislation based on the guidance in this directive. And that's got to do with whether or not Brussels has the authority to write a rule for everyone, or Brussels has the authority to request national legislation to be developed on these issues. And so it'll probably be about 2 or 3 years before national legislation then is developed in all the countries, and then another year or two before it is properly implemented. So the full scope of this regulation won't be implemented before 2027, 2028 is the expectation at the moment. Now, livelihoods seem to be a part of this regulation. And so actually ensuring that farmers and workers earn a living income and a living wage seems to be a part of the text, although the final texts haven't been finished yet and the final voting needs to still happen. And also within that context, we've also found that purchasing practices need to be reviewed in your living income and living wage policy. So on paper, it looks like it will mean that companies can't just say farmers need to grow their way out of poverty, which would be a good thing. And it also starts solving some of the problems that we see in the EUDR around who pays for the cost of compliance. Because if you're going to have to be able to earn a living wage or a living income, then your costs of production are also part of that. So it looks like the CSDDD might be stopping up some of the gaps that we have in the EUDR. And then the last regulation, the forced labor regulation, is a lot less further developed at the moment. So there's a lot of conversations around, are we talking about all forms of forced labor? Do all forms of forced labor have the same kind of interventions? Or are we going to start making a differentiation between state-sponsored forced labor, like the Uyghur slave camps in China, versus non-state approved forced labor, like trafficking in the cocoa sector? And they might actually need very different approaches. Now, where we are in that process, we're a lot earlier in the process, but unlike the due diligence directive, we're not too concerned about whether this forced labor regulation would be able to be passed in the next European Parliament. Like the point I brought up earlier in this conversation, we need to be quite concerned about the developments towards more extreme right-wing voting blocs in the world. That's also a concern around the next upcoming European Parliament elections. And so that's why we also want to have this corporate sustainability due diligence fixed and finalized before we have the elections and a new parliament. For the forced labor regulation, we're less concerned about that because it is, to all extents and purposes, an anti-China bill, and the right loves to bash China, etc. So we're more comfortable with letting that one go over that. With we, I mean, like, that's kind of the conversation I hear when I speak to other NGOs that are much closer to the flames in Brussels, because we dip our toe in the pool of Brussels on a regular basis, but there are other people that spend all day every day swimming deep in the waters there. So that's not so much us. But so those are the three big regulations that are coming up. It's also important to mention the fact that regulation isn't the only tool in the toolbox of the EU. And so kind of also kind of financial support and other forms of development support need to be a part of this conversation, because you can't just solve these problems from a demand side regulatory perspective. You need to have supply side enabling environment support as well. And that's also where I think decolonization of our work comes in as a very important point, is if we're going to require things to change in origin countries, then we're also going to have to be willing to come alongside and help develop what that enabling environment, and to create the conditions for that enabling environment to also be driven and owned locally. So
that's really brilliant. Thank you so much for telling us about the three main regulations that are in the pipeline. And also, it's really interesting to hear about the sustainability reporting regulation and the green claims. Is that also a regulation coming up? The green claims?
Yes. So I'm not aware enough yet about the particular details there. So this is really new on my radar. But the Commission is also looking at kind of how can companies claim sustainability, yes, no, what is, because so far, basically, you could put anything you wanted on your wrapper, and there's no real consequences for that being on there. So apparently, there's stuff coming on there. And I know, for example, in the coffee sector, they're looking at that regulation with a lot of interest, because in coffee, there's a lot of marketing around, direct trade and single farm. Yeah, but does that mean that it's sustainable? Yes or no? And also a lot of conversations around, for example, if it's certified, it's sustainable, right? And that's, I think that we need to be really clear. Certification does not mean it's sustainable. Complying to a certification process like a Rainforest Alliance or a Fair Trade or even an organic does not mean you comply to the EU regulatory suite of requirements, because there's just more that you need to do. And so I think that that's also going to be something that I'm starting to look into, but haven't really gone into depth there yet. But that's a definite part of the conversation, too. And I think it's going to be quite interesting, and especially around these claims around certification system or farm-based approaches, is when you have a farm-based approach to sustainability, on paper that looks quite interesting, but implicitly what you're saying is the farmer is the problem. And we would like to challenge that implicit assumption, because it's too much coincidence for it to be the farmer is the problem in cocoa, and the farmer is the problem in coffee, and the farmer is the problem in soy, and the farmer is the problem in palm oil and rubber and sugarcane and cattle. And actually, farmers in the tropics are pretty shit. They're really horrible, aren't they? Why don't, no, that's exactly, kind of, at some point you need to realize there's a real racism involved in the concept there, right? The farmer isn't the problem. The farmer has the problem. And the problem the farmer has is the global system. And the global system is it's not broken. It's working exactly the way it was designed to work. Commodities, which is the unifying factor among all these things. When you commodify something, you're doing exactly what we're seeing at the moment. Namely, you're making where something comes from and who made it completely irrelevant to the value of the product. The only thing, you know, this batch is completely interchangeable with that batch, and the only thing that differentiates the two of those is how much I'm paying for that, leading to the lowest possible price. That's what the system was designed to do, with all of the problems that come with that. And I talked about that at the beginning of this conversation. That is the root cause of all of this, is that farmers are not being paid enough. Right? And they're not being paid enough because the system was designed to have the weakest links in the supply chain compete with each other on price and on environmental harm. That's exactly what the system is doing, and it's delivering in spades. And so that's where we need to tackle what's going on. And I think that these regulatory developments are first steps down the road of realizing that you cannot require sustainability whilst completely laissez-faireing on how much farmers are paid. That's just not how it can credibly work going forward. And so I think that this is the first step, and maybe I'm being a hopelessly naive optimist here, but it's the first steps in realizing that this race to the bottom in price is actually part of the problem. It's also, these commodities markets are not how it has always worked, right? That they're relatively new inventions. And that means we can also design new things. That doesn't mean that we don't need the commodities markets. I actually think that they're very useful tools for hedging and for futures and for creating a stability of supply and demand for the traders and for the brands that need the products. But it doesn't mean that they should be the process that determines how much a farmer earns. And I actually think that companies don't have to pay the farmer what the world market system sets as the terminal market price. Most of the problems that we talk about, whether that's gender inequality, whether that's deforestation, whether that's rule of law, et cetera, companies rightfully point to origin governments and saying they've got a role to play here as well. They need to up their game. They need to do X, Y, Z. They need to build roads. They need to build schools. They need to be less corrupt. They need to invest more in local infrastructure. They need to have a rural development policy, all of those kind of things. Let's put in place a supply management system that the governments run. All of that, completely agree. But there's one thing that is completely within the control of companies, and that is actually not just within their control, it's their core business. And that core business is how they buy and sell the products that they buy and sell. Everything else is not core business. Their sustainability programs is not core business. Their deforestation programs is not core business. Their gender equality programs are not core business. How they buy and sell their products are their core business. So, and they have full control over that. So why should a regulation not require the core business of the company over which they have complete control to not be a driver to the key issues, right? And I think that that's where we're getting to one of the key problems of sustainability conversations, right? For decades now, we've been having sustainability conversations across a whole range of commodities, right? Not just cocoa, not just coffee, but, you know, bananas and I don't know what. And we haven't solved any of the problems. Farmers are still poor, trees are still being cut down, and children are still working. Why is that? Why haven't we solved the problem? Because we didn't have to. It was always optional for companies to do so. And if they didn't do it, there were no real consequences. It was an option if it fit with your, if you had some space in your budget, or if your CEO woke up that morning and had a nice cup of coffee and thought, wouldn't it be great if we do something for the coffee farmers? And if they felt like it. But if they didn't feel like it, nobody would go to jail. Nobody would get slapped with a fine. Nobody would lose their market access. The worst thing that could happen is a couple of angry vegan leftist activists would send out a few tweets. That's just about the worst thing that could happen. And even that already companies weren't very comfortable with. But there was no consequences to destroying the planet and exploiting the people living on it. And that is changing. And so I think driving this forward, companies are going to start to have to. And that's going to require a lot of change. And they're like, oh, this is hard to do. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we need to do things differently. Yep. Yep. If the regulation wasn't asking you to do something that was hard and different than what you were doing right now, then we wouldn't need the regulation in the first place.
Thank you. That's so interesting. I want to jump back to a point we were talking about before, which was representation. Do you feel like smallholder cocoa farmers and cocoa producing countries were consulted in the negotiations for these directives and regulations? And do you think this could have been done better or differently? And how would you have done it?
Yes. It's a short answer, yes. I mean, the EU does have processes of talking to member states, talking to a lot of stakeholders, and especially around the EUDR, that whole process has gone through the standard process of consultations, etc. Now, they didn't do a proper consultation on the rights holders that were going to be affected, and then they didn't put that into the requirements. And I think that that's where you get the big challenge, that costs of compliance are not part of the regulation. And so basically everyone's kicking the can up the road until you get to a point where somebody can no longer kick the can up the road because there's either no more road or no power to kick. And so you end up with the farmers, generally speaking. So that really is something that needs to be reviewed over time. I think for the CSDDD, that's been even less transparent in general, right? But I think both of these regulations, if you look specifically at cocoa, actually the commission has done a really good job of talking to the cocoa sector. So for the last 3 years, 4 years, they've been holding a whole series of events called Cocoa Talks, where at very high level, they've been bringing in the key producer nations, key industry stakeholders, but also key civil society representatives. For top-level discussions, both in public through I'm saying the past 4 years. So we all know this, most of this was through Zoom. but that actually also lowered the threshold of bringing people on board. And I actually think that the pandemic, horrible as it was, has had several unintended positive consequences. And probably the most important one being that it has become much more easy and accepted and common practice to bring in voices from around the world. And when you, so civil society voices from the South have been able to be a part of this. Now, they have sometimes chosen not to. And one of the reasons for that is the fact that when you have a dynamic where the EU is trying to start something and there are national governments involved in the conversation in producer nations, if local civil society would speak up and say, we like this law, when the national government is saying they don't, or they're concerned about things, then it makes these NGOs look like they're choosing the side of the EU versus their governments. And that could strongly limit their space to operate within those countries. And so sometimes within this position of inclusion, our job as an ally is to say the things that our allies in the South, our partners in the South, cannot. And so to use our privilege as a shield to say stuff that others can't. And so that's part of the job that we have now, is identify where can we take the blows for others, right? Also because for others, it might be a blow, and for us, it would just be a brush, right? So the worst thing that could happen is I don't get a visa to go to Cote d'Ivoire or Ghana or a country like that anymore. Now, sure, that would be an inconvenience, but I'd be able to survive. But on the other hand, producer governments are quite satisfied with the work we do, because we also challenge the companies and they need that. So, you know, we never play favorites. Kind of, we think, yes, the governments need to change, but also the companies need to change. So around the inclusion level on the regulation, I think specifically from a cocoa sector, there actually has been more of an open dialogue around this. Although I think it has to be said that the conversation the EU has been having around this is largely coming from DG INTPA and DG's trade, which are like on international partnerships and on trade, whereas the environmental regulation is coming through DG Envy. And so kind of how these conversations have influenced the development of the regulation themselves, I think you could probably be quite skeptical about. Thankfully, there is a review round for the EUDR planned for in 2 or 3 years' time. And I think that's a really important thing to say as well. As I said earlier here, we're going through a paradigm shift. We're really seeing governments doing completely new things. And like this suite of regulations is a whole set of new instruments. And when you develop a new instrument, when you first put it into play, you're going to have to calibrate it. And it takes some time for that calibration to be there. So we're not expecting all the problems to be solved by this regulation. We're actually not expecting this regulation to be able to do everything it's aimed to do in its first 1 or 2 or 3 iterations. You know, this is something that we need to be actively and consistently involved in for the next 10, 15 years to ensure that the development of these suite of regulations for the coming decade or two goes in the right direction, amongst other reasons, because if we don't, then we know who will be in the room, right? So that's going to be a really important part of it. And that's where you have a challenge as NGOs, because NGOs are about as reliable as their next funding round. And so it's very hard to be sure that the individual NGOs will keep this consistent pressure on. And that's where you need organizations like an umbrella organization, where we know our members might not all be able to do this, but as a collective, we can still keep the pressure on regardless of individual member priorities. And so we will keep following this consistently for quite a while.
That's fantastic. That's really, really interesting to hear about. You've highlighted the importance of chocolate companies paying and living income and developing good purchasing practices. Could you tell us a little bit about what these good purchasing practices would look like? Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's a chocolate company in the sector that's doing it really, really well? Or if not, why not?
Yeah, so unpacking this a little bit, and I'll try to give a bit of a I know that I'm realizing I'm giving really long, expansive answers here. This ties into the point I was bringing in earlier around this is the core business of what companies do, how they buy and sell their products. And the most obvious first step, and we've been pushing this for a very long time, right, around kind of, guys, we need to pay the farmers better. And until very recently, the response of the cocoa sector was no. The market will solve that. We've seen a slight shift over the last, I'd say, year and a half, where the answer to that is less often no, although we often enough it still is no. But increasingly, part of the response is, so how would we do that? What are we talking about when you talk about that, right? So now that's an interesting shift, and I find it an important shift. And so when the company started asking how, well, then you need to have some directional answers, right? So, and the most obvious how is just pay them more, right? It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this out. You know, we care desperately about the farmers being poor. What could we possibly do? Well, maybe give them more money. It's quite, and the thing is that across the board, whether this is in commodities or whether this is homeless people in Canada or anywhere, what we see, what the research shows time and time again, if people are poor and you give them more money, they will make better decisions, full stop, across the board, regardless of which country or what the situation is. Give people money, and when the dire poverty is less of a problem, they will make better decisions, full stop. So giving them more money is the first step in that. And we actually think that technically speaking, the way to do that is by calculating what a household should be earning for a living income and then working backwards from that to calculate how much you should be paying them based on cost of production, based on kind of what the tonnage is that they do, et cetera, et cetera. Also, this shouldn't be revolutionary or very complex. It still is maths that I can do. And if I can do the maths, then a company can definitely do the maths on that, because I'm not particularly very good at numbers. And so this concept is called a living income reference price. It's a price that you pay that the average farmer can earn a living income. Now, there's always complexities around that because an average farmer doesn't exist, right? There will always be smaller or bigger farms or smaller or bigger households or higher or lower yields, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the average needs to be able to earn that. But it's not just about price, right? Purchasing practices are also about risk. And so we've done extensive consultations with farmer organizations in producer countries around these purchasing practices, asking them, what do you guys need? And the biggest risk that farmers run is the fact that companies renege on their contracts the whole damn time. And so they need companies to respect the contracts, not just pay a fair price, but respect the contracts around tonnage, around payments of premiums, around when do they pay, all of those kind of things. But also standardized contracts would be a really important part of it, as well as contracts that reduce risk for farmers. So put in place long-term contracts rather than farmers are dependent every year. Oh, I hope we're going to sell the right amount to a fair price. No, why don't you put in place long-term contracts that you give farmers a security for 3 to 5 years? We know how much we're going to be selling, and we know how much we're going to be selling it for. Nestlé knows how much cocoa they need in 7 years' time. There is no reason for them not to give that security further downstream, right? Or Cargill, their suppliers, et cetera, et cetera. So this is something that the companies could and should do, because at the moment, it's not just that the farmers are being paid little, they're also bearing the biggest risks. And so purchasing practices, pay a fair price, reduce the risk of farmers. And then the third thing is be accountable about this. And so be transparent about how you have your policies around purchasing, and regularly report, like on an annual basis through key performance indicators, on these are our purchasing principles and this is how we're actually sticking to those purchasing principles. That, in a nutshell, pay a fair price, reduce the risk of farmers, be accountable on it. That, in a nutshell, is what we're talking about purchasing practices. And we think that that should be the key of a regulation. When you say, hey, look, if you know poverty is a problem, are you paying a fair price? Are you reducing the risk of farmers? Are you being accountable about it?
Thank you. I think we're kind of running close to the clock here. Mm-hmm. So we actually had some questions on climate, but I think it's such a deep topic. Maybe we should keep those for another podcast, because it feels like it's a whole other topic to delve upon.
More than willing to do it, but it because it is so important. Like, I once saw this poster that said, save the planet. It's the only one with chocolate. And climate change is not a future problem for cocoa. It's a now problem for cocoa. So the first time I went to Cote d'Ivoire, which is like more than a decade ago, we drove through a part of the country for hours where the trees were without leaves. And that's not because they have seasons there, but because certain parts of the country there have already become less amenable to growing cocoa. And it's also a problem for coffee. Like, coffee is even more fickle and dependent on climate. And so climate change is a real threat to our luxury. I think that consumers very seldom realize that. We can't keep going on like this, because we're going to run out of the stuff that we love.
Yeah, thank you. That is a major issue. Actually, I do have a very, very quick question I'd like to slide in on that. Do you think it's going to affect the wages and the livelihood? Because I imagine it's going to make chocolate scarcer, so people will be willing to pay less, but at the same time.
Well, there's a lot of economics behind that answer. So how much a farmer is paid for their cocoa or for their coffee has very little to do with how much we as consumers pay for our cocoa or coffee, right? Companies will use the excuse of higher farm gate prices to raise prices here, but that's just so that they can actually get more profits, right? The whole kind of grabflation, as they've called it over the last couple of years. Supermarkets have had fantastic years because they're just raking in the profits, right? Climate change is particularly bad for the farmers because they can grow less cocoa, because they can grow less coffee. And even if the price goes up, if their yields go down, they're still screwed. So there's a real challenge there. But how much we pay as a consumer is only tangentially influenced by how much it costs to grow the commodity at the beginning of the supply chain. There's a real disconnect there that once you start looking at the numbers, you're just like, how the hell is that possible? What do you mean? Right? So, farm gate prices have very little to do with end consumer prices, full stop.
Okay, thank you. Sefi, did you have one last question, or we prepared three yes or no questions that we feel could really wrap it well?
Let's try that.
Okay, so if we're ready for those. So the first is, and it's pretty much linked to what we've been saying right here, will we still be able to eat chocolate in 20 years?
Yes.
Can chocolate ever be sustainable?
Absolutely.
And are the EUDR and the CSDDD what you hoped they would be?
Oof. that's like a Schrodinger's cat answer. The answer is both yes and no.
Okay. That's great. Thank you. It's been so interesting. Steffi, do you want to wrap things up?
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you so much, Anthony, for coming on the podcast today. It's been incredibly interesting. We've really enjoyed having you on and having this conversation about cocoa, EU regulatory developments, and what that will mean for the cocoa sector and for rights holders in the global south, who the extent to which they've been adequately consulted for these regulations and the extent to which they'll be impacted by these regulations and the support that they have with complying with these regulations is quite dubious at the moment, I think, and it's been really good to hear more about that and for you to really inform us. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed this.
That was so interesting. I think it was really good for our audience.
I mean, and there's a lot of conversations around the climate, the deforestation aspect, and like especially in West Africa, it actually is a microcosm of what climate change in the rest of the world will look like in the future, because they've cut down like 90% of the old growth forests there. And so rainforests are rain machines, and you cut down the rain machines, then you basically change rainfall patterns. And so the climate has changed drastically there over the past years, where things are getting hotter, more humid, but also the dry, dusty winds from the Harmattan, from the Sahel, come down further south every year, and they come down earlier and they leave later. The Sahel is also creeping south, and they're trying to, this great green belt idea of we're going to plant shitloads of trees across the whole edge of the Sahel, but they're not doing that. And it's really interesting to show kind of this is our futures, is weather patterns really change. Although when I would say this 2 or 3 years ago, that sounded more like a dystopian future than if we look at how the summers and the winters have been here in Europe over the last 2 or 3 years. We're like, oh yes, it's our current now. Climate change has become a now problem in Europe over the past 2 or 3 years as well. So yeah.
And I'm really interested, sorry, it's just to ask you, do you see cocoa production as a result of changing weather patterns and climatic conditions and a decrease in soil fertility and rainfall as a result of deforestation? Do you see cocoa production shifting away from West Africa, away from Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana towards Latin America or Indonesia?
So I think Indonesia, not so much. And the main reason for that is cocoa is very much a poverty product. And in Indonesia, they're too rich to really care much about growing cocoa. I mean, not that Indonesians are rich, but at least they're not as desperately poor as in West Africa. Latin America has a different dynamic there. And I think that then you need to be looking at individual countries and the individual differences there. Like, both Ecuador and Peru are growing substantially at the moment, but Peru has a long way to come because they're tiny. But they've got a huge pot of money from the U.S. government. In their war on drugs, the USAID is paying a lot of money per farmer to switch from cocaine to cocoa growing. And that is causing a lot of deforestation. because the coca plants would be grown under tree cover so that the satellite imagery couldn't find them because they were doing illicit growth. The cocoa is fine. And so, let's cut down the forest above it so that we can grow more cocoa per hectare. So there's some real challenges there. In Ecuador, you're seeing an even stronger growth at the moment. And that's not because of war on drugs money, but because the Ecuadorian government over the last 10, 12 years has been putting in place policies that are actually highly beneficial to cocoa farmers. They've actually got a good – Ecuador is a really good example of what happens when a government gets their act together and creates the proper enabling environment for farmers to flourish. Obviously, recent developments in Ecuador are less than optimal for this. But still, the cocoa production and the cocoa exports aren't really – hurting much from this. And in fact, the drug traders in Ecuador need the tropical exports in order to actually get their shipments of cocaine up to Europe. So it's highly cynical there. But yes, we're seeing, and I actually think Ecuador will overtake Ghana before the end of this decade as the world's second biggest cocoa producer. The big challenge for cocoa is to switch from historically cocoa's been a slash and burn crop, right? So basically going to a piece of old growth rainforest, cut it down, highly fertile soil for 30, 40 years, run your plantation there until the trees and the soils are depleted, and then go to the next part and repeat that over and over again. Cocoa needs to switch from a slash and burn to a sedentary crop. And it really hasn't found that solution yet, with the exception of Ecuador. And the reason why Ecuador is the exception is they're actually the biggest growth of cocoa in Ecuador is in the western coastal regions, which were deforested by Spanish conquistadors back in the 18th and 19th centuries in order to build their ships. And so that is actually previously degraded land where cocoa trees are actually now playing a role in reforestation. So even though there are large monoculture cocoa tree farms, it still is better than the degraded grasslands that were there previously. So it's really interesting to see the dynamic there. That's not to say that Ecuador doesn't have problems. It's just that West Africa would love to have Ecuador's problems.
Yeah. And what's like the, because under the EUDR, sorry, I have so many questions. Mm-hmm. Under the EUDR, how is agroforestry seen? Because I've read that in Latin America, for instance, where cocoa is a native crop, it can be considered reforestation versus in West Africa, where it's not a native crop, it can't be. To what extent is that true? Like how would that be regulated? Will the EUDR actually help the development of cocoa or in Latin America?
So the way cocoa is a native crop to Latin America is as one of many hundreds of species varieties per hectare, as one of at least 4 to 5 layers of canopy in a rainforest.
Yeah, because it's a shade crop, right? So
it's like a cocoa tree gets maybe 10 meters, 12 meters at highest if it really grows tall. And it does that within the context of 4 or 5 different canopy levels in an old growth rainforest. So it would probably be at about the second canopy level, and then that would have 3 canopies above it in a proper real rainforest concept. So there are some cocoa production systems, particularly in northwest Brazil, southeast Colombia, and kind of the easternmost point of Ecuador, that do cocoa almost like that. That's called the cacao silvestre system. Very, very rare to find cocoa coming out of a cacao silvestre program. And so anybody that says, it's endemic to here and so it's not deforestation, basically are lying. Because yes, it's endemic as one of the trees within a very complex rainforest system. And that's not how cocoa is grown for export, full stop. So it's disingenuous at best.
Yeah, so how is that regarded by within the EUDR? Would it count as deforestation if in Latin America if then you were to plant? Or How does that function?
If the land has been cut down or degraded on or after the 1st of January 2020, it doesn't matter what part of the world that land has been degraded or deforested.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So if you have a desiccated, degraded grassland that was deforested 230 years ago and you start putting cocoa trees on there, the EUDR doesn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a piece of the Amazon that you're switching from an old growth Amazon to having like a 20 to 30% cocoa tree aspect under old growth forest cover, and you've decided to do that as of now, then you're not going to be able to sell to the EU.
Okay, that makes sense. And in terms of the grassland that you were mentioning,
mm-hmm.
on the west coast of Ecuador, yeah. given that it was deforested so many years ago by the Spanish conquistadors,
mm-hmm.
Surely it would have a level of biodiversity value in terms of it would be a relatively well-established ecosystem, or has it sort of been degraded over the years by other infrastructural development factors?
So it's a semi-arid landscape, but also a desert has an ecosystem and a biodiversity value of its own. But bringing in carbon capture, bringing in several canopy layers, etc., is often a way forward. Now, we're not big fans of large monoculture farms, right? And so I have mixed feelings about when I go there. I see farms that are a lot more agroforestry based, and I every time I'm on one of those, I'm like, yeah, this is better. But I'm also not blind to the arguments where at scale, a large plantation that does proper tree distances, et cetera, and does operate with the best technology actually might take up less land to grow more cocoa. And so allowing for other land to be given back to nature. Now, the problem is that far too seldom actually happens, because if you can use this land with such an economic viability, then you'd be stupid to give it back to nature, wouldn't you? Right. So there's that really big part of the consideration there, too. So I like to think of myself as incredibly principled, but then when push comes to shove, I realize that how you do it often is more important than exactly how pure your theory is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting. It's very interesting. And just really quickly, are these plantations in West Ecuador, are they smallholder owned or are they big plantations with hired workers?
So they tend to be the latter. There are those in the former. They tend to be a little bit closer to the Andes, a little bit more towards the forested areas as well. But there's a whole series of very large scale industrial farms that have several villages on the finca or on the hacienda there. So I've visited several of them. And it's a very different kind of production system there. And then you become very dependent on what kind of farm owner / manager you have as to whether or not it's a nice place to work. Now, having said that, Ecuador did introduce a massive escalation of minimum wages for workers about 10 years ago that has made it less bad to be a worker.
Thank you so much, Anthony Fountain, for joining us on this new podcast. I hope you all enjoyed it, and I look forward to seeing you on the next podcast at PLUK